Sobibor, and none of them were located in Germany. The typical concentration camp was not a death camp. It had no gas chambers. The vast majority of Jews killed in the Holocaust, Timothy Snyder writes, never saw a concentration camp. Nazi concentration camps included Jews, but the majority of the captives were Russians and Eastern Europeans. These were labor camps, just like the democratic slave camps. They put between 8 and 12 million people to work to serve the Nazi state, especially the Nazi armaments industry. Studies by German scholars of this topic bear titles like Hitler's Slaves and Slave Labor in Nazi Concentration Camps. In his study of concentration camps, Wolfgang Sofsky notes that slave camps and Nazi concentration camps were both forced labor systems, in which the captives received no compensation for their labor, and masters had virtually unlimited power over them, not merely their work conditions, but their lives. The prisoners in both cases were reduced to complete and vulnerable dependency. Masters in both cases could compel their captives to work without a break, beat them, torment them, or hound them to death. Remarkably, the captives in forced labor systems all display similar characteristics. Sofsky describes the work routine for Nazi captives. For the prisoner, putting on the brakes was the supreme dictate. Work tempo was reduced to a minimum as soon as the guards or capo were out of sight. When the superior returned, prisoners did their utmost to appear as if they were working at a brisk pace. Replace the term capo with planter or overseer, and Sofsky could be describing a democratic slave plantation in Virginia or South Carolina. What protected the slave to a certain degree, Sofsky argues, was his or her status as property. The slave has a value and a going market price. The master does not acquire slaves in order to kill them, but to put them to work for the master's benefit. As barbaric as the owners often were in dealing with their slaves, the death of a slave was a loss. By contrast, the Nazi prisoners were not the personal property of masters, but inmates of an institution. They belonged to no one. Thus, if they were killed, no one cared. Sofsky also notes that both the slave camps and the Nazi camps were systems based on racial classification. Slavery, of course, drew a sharp racial line between the typically white slave owner and black slave. In the Nazi camps, there was a variety of inferior groups, each of which wore a distinguishing badge. Criminals wore a green badge, nonconformists or asocials a black badge, political dissidents a red triangle, foreigners a red triangle with their nationality marked on it, gypsies brown triangles, and Jews the Star of David. The close connection between democratic plantations and Nazi labor camps was noted in the early 1970s by progressive historian Stanley Elkins, who pointed out that both the slave plantation and the concentration camp were closed systems, cut off from the larger society. Consequently, he argued, they generated similar types of dysfunctional personalities. Essentially, Elkins argues that the captives internalized their systems of oppression. Jewish capos served the Nazi machine, just as black overseers served the democratic planters. Even those who did not become part of the regime of oppression found their moral personality disfigured. As a survival mechanism, concentration camp victims developed submissive, stereotypical patterns of behavior that were also regularly observed on the slave plantation, the so-called Sambo syndrome. Moreover, where did Hitler get his idea for reducing Russians, Poles, and Eastern Europeans to slavery? According to progressive historian Timothy Snyder, he got it from the Jacksonian Democrats of the 19th century. Hitler's initial plan had been for Germany to undertake colonial expeditions similar to those of the French and the British. Hitler realized, however, that most of the valuable real estate in Asia, Africa, and South America had already been taken. German colonial opportunities in the early 20th century were very limited. Then Hitler remembered what Andrew Jackson and his successors did to the American Indians. Jackson's Indian Removal Act had driven tens of thousands of Indians, the Chickasaw, the Choctaw, the Creek, and the Seminole out of their ancestral homes, forcing them to relocate farther west. When the Cherokee resisted, they were forcibly removed, leading to the infamous Trail of Tears. In Hitler's own summary, Americans had gunned down the millions of Redskins to a few hundred thousand and now keep the modest remnant under observation in a cage. This gave Hitler a new idea. Why bother to conquer in Asia and Africa when he could conquer the natives in Europe itself? Hitler's plan was to emulate the Jacksonian Democrats in driving the Russians, the Poles, and the Eastern Europeans from their homes. They would be forced to relocate elsewhere. The ones who resisted would be killed, the ones who stayed would be enslaved and sent to German labor camps. Hitler's scheme was called General Plan Ost. Snyder reports that the Nazis sought to deport, kill, assimilate, or enslave some 30 to 45 million people. They planned to create on their land small German farming communities. Snyder writes, colonization would make of Germany a continental empire fit to rival the United States, another hardy frontier state based on exterminatory colonialism and slave labor. As Hitler imagined the future, Germany would deal with the Slavs much as the North Americans had dealt with the Indians. The Volga River in Russia, he once proclaimed, will be Germany's Mississippi. Hitler, interestingly enough, was also a fan of the Ku Klux Klan. He seemed to think it was a political movement similar to his own, reports Ernst Hanstegel, a friend of Hitler's who served as his head of the Foreign Press Bureau. Hitler appears to have recognized, as Woodrow Wilson did before him, that if the centralized state were to serve as a new type of big house, administering a new type of state-run plantation, then it too would require an organization to serve as a kind of whip to keep the subjugated people in line. Hitler was undoubtedly aware of the close parallels between the Klan and the Nazi brownshirts because many Germans and American observers noted them at the time. At their peak, both groups had 3 to 4 million members. Both were paramilitary organizations that practiced racial terrorism. Both targeted racial minorities, in one case blacks, in the other Jews. And both were extensions of a political party, the Klan of the Democratic Party, the Brownshirts of the Nazi Party. Thus, the concept of a fascist plantation is hardly far-fetched. FDR and the KKK. FDR's relationship to fascism, however, requires a little introduction. FDR was obviously not a racial nationalist like Hitler, but he did maintain a fairly close relationship with racially nationalist groups in America. Since we are discussing the Klan, it may be useful to begin with FDR's close connection with Woodrow Wilson, the progressive Democrat largely responsible for the nationwide revival of the Klan. FDR, of course, served as Navy Secretary in the Wilson administration. Not once during his tenure did he criticize Wilson's KKK affinities and racist policies or indicate the slightest discomfort with them. Yet progressives who distance themselves from Wilson, or at least from the racist side of Wilson, never distance themselves from FDR. FDR remains the great progressive hero, routinely invoked by Democrats today as their inspiration and ideal. FDR's progressive biographers, such as Arthur Schlesinger Jr., William Lichtenberg, and Robert Dalek, speak of him in hagiographical terms, leaving little doubt they consider him one of America's greatest, if not the greatest, president. Except for a brief, throat-clearing reference to FDR's internment of Japanese Americans, seemingly explained by the exigencies of war, little or nothing is said about FDR's racist ties or the racist policies of the FDR administration. Yet although his ties were obviously less direct than Wilson's, FDR had a much closer association with the Ku Klux Klan than any of his biographers are willing to admit. His successor, Harry Truman, was briefly a member of the Klan. Progressives who credit Truman with desegregating the armed forces rarely mention this. If they do, they insist that Truman wasn't a racist, he was merely anti-Catholic. This is the same Truman who wrote to his future wife, Bess, "I think one man is just as good as another, so long as he's honest and decent and not a nigger or a Chinaman." Truman added, "Uncle Will says that the Lord made a white man from dust, a nigger from mud, then he threw up what was left and it came down a Chinaman. He does hate Chinese and Japs, so do I. I'm strongly of the opinion that Negroes ought to be in Africa, yellow men in Asia, and white men in Europe and America." As late as 1963, Truman, in a newspaper interview, asked a reporter, "Would you want your daughter to marry a Negro?" One of FDR's closest political allies and most enthusiastic supporters in the Senate was Mississippi Democrat Theodore Bilbo, the state's leading progressive. Bilbo campaigned for FDR in 1932. And FDR returned the favor, helping Bilbo win a Senate seat in 1934. In 1940, when Bilbo won re-election, FDR proclaimed him a real friend of liberal government, and Bilbo routinely characterized himself as 100% for Roosevelt and the New Deal. A longtime member of the Ku Klux Klan, Bilbo championed its agenda of segregation and resistance to racial intermarriage, which he termed mongrelization. He tried, albeit unsuccessfully, to segregate the national parks, and publicly defended lynching as a necessary punishment for Negro rapists. Bilbo served 12 years in the Senate from 1935 to 1947. During that time, FDR worked closely with him, not merely on New Deal initiatives, but also to resist racial integration in the armed forces and to suppress anti-lynching legislation. In the House of Representatives, FDR relied on a whole constellation of racist Democrats to push through his agenda, notably Texas Democrat Sam Rayburn, who would become Speaker of the House. Rayburn campaigned for FDR and against Hoover on the grounds that Hoover sought to abolish segregation and promote a deal with Negroes. What he liked about FDR, presumably, was that he was for segregation and against finding common ground with blacks. Rayburn was an avid segregationist who explained to an audience at First Baptist Church in Bonham, Texas, in 1928, why he could never be a Republican. "I will never vote for the electors of a party which sent the carpetbagger and the scalawag to the prostrate South with saber and sword to crush the white civilization to the earth." This same Rayburn was a critical progressive ally, not only of FDR, but also his Democratic successors Truman and later Lyndon Johnson. FDR also nominated Klan member Hugo Black, an Alabama Democrat, to the Supreme Court. Black had altered his resume to camouflage his Klan association. Yet Black's Klan ties were well known. His law partner, Crampton Harris, the Cyclops of the Birmingham Klan, had initiated Black into the organization. Black became an active member, marching in parades and addressing Klan rallies throughout Alabama. When Black ran for Senate as a Democrat in 1926, he had the Klan's endorsement, and his election was celebrated by the Klan in a ceremony attended by Imperial Wizard Hiram Evans, who presented Black with a gold-engraved lifetime passport to the invisible empire of the Klan. When all of this was exposed in the Pittsburgh Post following Black's confirmation to the court, Black protested that he had merely joined the Klan to advance his career. The Klan, he said, was in effect the underground Democratic Party in Alabama. This statement is both true and telling. Many years later, Bill Clinton would say something very similar about another Democratic Klansman, Robert Byrd, who went on to become Senate Majority Leader and mentor to Bill and Hillary Clinton. Bill Clinton undertook to explain why Americans should not be too hard on Byrd for his fleeting association with the Klan. Byrd's association was hardly fleeting, but we'll let that pass. "What does that mean?" Clinton thundered. "I'll tell you what it means. He was a country boy from the hills and hollows of West Virginia. He was trying to get elected." In other words, you simply had to be in the Klan in those days to advance in the Democratic Party. Ever the consummate political dissembler, FDR pretended he had no idea that Black had been in the Klan. But even FDR's progressive biographer Robert Dalek, a sycophantic admirer if there ever was one, admits that in choosing Black there seemed little question that Roosevelt was aware of his Klan membership and that his election to the Senate had partly required Klan support. Many years later, Black himself put the matter to rest in a 1968 memo. "President Roosevelt told me," he said, "there was no reason for my worrying about having been a member of the Ku Klux Klan. He said that some of his best friends and supporters were strong members of that organization. He never in any way, by word or attitude, indicated any doubt about my having been in the Klan, nor did he indicate any criticism of me for having been a member of that organization." A fascist superhero. Notice that the Klan connections of these leading Democrats are much more recent than those of, say, Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest, a founder of the 19th century Klan. Yet Forrest statues are torn down by progressives while FDRs are left standing. In fact, there's no indication on the part of left-wing monument destroyers that they are even ambivalent about FDR's racist legacy. The same applies to Harry Truman, Hugo Black, Sam Rayburn, and Robert Byrd. No one to date has called for the renaming of the Rayburn House office building in Washington, D.C. A good deal of West Virginia is named after Robert Byrd. Highways, schools, medical centers, and so on. They are all given a pass by progressive activists. Apparently it's just fine to have served or worked with the Ku Klux Klan as long as you are a progressive Democrat. In fairness, many of the Black Lives Matter and Antifa thugs who pulled down monuments probably have no idea about FDR's connection to Black or Black's deep ties to the Klan. Here we are back to the big lies of omission, the systematic progressive erasure of important events and associations to hide the complicity of big-name progressives in the worst crimes of American history. As we will see in this chapter, few people have benefited more from this left-wing cover-up than FDR. FDR's reputation remains that of the indefatigable hero of the Depression and World War II, famously associated with the phrase, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." I have never understood the appeal of this idiotic phrase. Imagine going to a hospital to be treated for a serious life-threatening illness and being informed by the person in charge that the only thing you have to fear is fear itself. Au contraire, dummy, the only thing I have to fear is the sickness that's killing me. The fear is a natural, reasonable response to that. Fear during the Depression was fear of bankruptcy, of joblessness and starvation and total ruin. It was rational fear. The only way to remove the fear was to remove the underlying cause of the fear. This FDR did not do. The Depression continued throughout all his four terms in office. In the decade of the 1930s, industrial production and national income fell by almost one-third. Historians now agree that it only ended with World War II and the manufacturing boom of the late 1940s and 1950s. Even so, just 4 years after he first used the phrase, FDR in his 1936 renomination speech recalled, "In those days we feared fear. That's why we fought fear. And today, my friends, we have conquered fear." This is capital stuff, reminiscent of Peter Sellers in the movie Being There. Sellers plays Chance, a gardener who utters pedestrian banalities and absurdities, mostly drawing on an analogy to gardening. Yet these enigmatic pronouncements are hailed by the elite as profundities. So too with FDR, who is routinely celebrated by progressives for profundities that are not profound and for doing things that he manifestly did not do. As I mentioned earlier, FDR deserves no credit for ending the Great Depression. I will acknowledge his role in leading the American fight against the fascists and Nazis during World War II. The soldiers and those aiding the war effort turned the tide against the enemy. The Red Army, too, played a critical role in defeating the Axis powers. Even so, FDR's wartime leadership undoubtedly accelerated Germany's final defeat. Yet it must also be admitted that these later developments of the 1940s have helped progressives to conceal FDR's much friendlier and indeed more intimate relationship to fascism and Nazism in the previous decade. In truth, FDR admired Mussolini and embraced fascist principles that had been implemented both in Italy by Mussolini and in Germany by Hitler. For their part, in the early 1930s, the Italian and German fascists praised FDR and the New Deal. FDR and the fascists were part of a mutual admiration society. Showing these connections is telling enough. But in order to go further, we need to make a searching examination of the true meaning of fascism. We need to understand how FDR's New Deal drew on the formulas of Italian fascism, how FDR, like Hitler, appealed to envy and hatred of successful entrepreneurs in order to mobilize political action against them, how fascist concepts like Gleichschaltung, which basically means political correctness, were embraced by progressives, and how fascist economic policy is at the core of the progressive democratic plantation even today. True, Wilson envisioned the progressive plantation long before FDR. But FDR deserves credit, or more precisely, blame, for the fascist plantation. Wilson cannot be held responsible for it because he preceded Mussolini and Hitler. Consequently, there is no way he could have had these fascist dictators as models. FDR did learn from both of them, and moreover, like Mussolini and Hitler, he had the economic catastrophe of the Great Depression to justify moving his country in a direction that the people would never ordinarily want to go. One way to see how FDR embraced Nazi policies is to consider the distinctive fascist approach to economic policy, followed by Mussolini as well as Hitler. The fascists were socialists, but not in the Marxist way. Their national socialism did not involve nationalization of industry or worker control of various industries. Rather, it involved government control of the major sectors of the private economy. Fascism is state-directed capitalism. This became FDR's approach, and subsequent generations of progressive Democrats have made it their own. As we will see, the New Deal's signature initiative, the National Recovery Act, was explicitly modeled on fascism and administered by an FDR man who was a devotee of Mussolini. FDR's closest advisors like Rexford Tugwell openly praised fascism, which they recognized as leftist and which they considered more progressive than the New Deal. Fascism's influence on the New Deal was recognized by contemporaries such as Herbert Hoover, who warned, "If we continue down this New Deal road, ours can become some sort of fascist government." Reagan, too, in the quotation that opens this chapter, knew from his youth the close nexus between fascism and American progressivism. Imagine what Hoover and Reagan would have said had they lived to see how much these fascist roots have blossomed among Democrats in our own time. Case in point, Obamacare. Already I can envision the progressive eruption. So what precisely is fascist about Obamacare? Look at the way that Obama greatly increased government control, not only over healthcare, every hospital, every doctor, every health insurance company, but also over the financial sector, every bank, every investment house, and increasingly over the energy, automobile, and education sectors as well. Obama didn't nationalize these industries in the typical socialist mode, nor did he give workers control over the means of production, as Marx advocated. Rather, he extended government control over these major sectors of the economy, giving him the power in 2009 to fire Rick Wagoner, the CEO of General Motors, or to direct health insurance companies on whom to cover and on what terms. Obama blithely went down this road. It never occurred to him to go down any other road. And whether he knew it or not, he used the fascist model of state-directed capitalism that has come down to him and to the Democratic Party from FDR. FDR got some other big things from the Nazis, the politics of class hatred and enforced cultural conformity, and I'll get to them. But I also want to highlight that there is one big thing FDR did not share with Hitler and Mussolini. They were dictators, and he was not. Admittedly, FDR had dictatorial instincts. Some leading progressives like Walter Lippmann, in complete seriousness, urged FDR to assume dictatorial powers. To his credit, FDR declined. But at times he moved in a dictatorial direction, as when he tried to stack the Supreme Court and thus subvert the institution of an independent judiciary. But in general, FDR remained the elected leader of a constitutional democracy. This meant that, unlike Mussolini and Hitler, FDR had to build a political coalition to get himself re-elected. He had to build democratic constituencies for his fascist agenda, which meant he had to invent a peculiarly American brand of fascism. He did this by abandoning the old Van Buren strategy of mobilizing urban plantations, each run by a big city boss, and replacing this decentralized Tammany model with a new model of a single national plantation with the White House as the big house and the president as Massa. This FDR model has proven both politically successful and extremely attractive to progressive seekers of power. Here, after all, is a chance to be Massa, not of a single plantation as in the days of old, but of an American plantation. Who said that exploitation can't be fun? LBJ, Bill Clinton, and Obama all adopted FDR's model in enthusiastic succession. And how each of them has enjoyed being Massa, including Obama, the first African-American inhabitant of the Democratic Big House. FDR saw himself as a kind of fascist superhero, not in the Hitler mode, but in the Mussolini mode. But even before the end of World War II, even prior to U.S. troops entering the concentration camps, FDR knew how Americans had come to view fascism and Nazism and that he had to bury his past associations with both. Fascism had become politically radioactive. So FDR himself began the project that progressives have continued ever since, one of burying and entombing their own idolization of the fascist project. At the same time, progressives began to redefine fascism and Nazism in such a way that they could project these evils onto the right, so that future generations would be bamboozled into thinking that the Republicans, not the Democrats, the conservatives, not the progressives, were in bed with Mussolini and Hitler in the critical decades leading up to global war and Holocaust. The big lie about race thus expands to incorporate a big lie about fascism and Nazism. How the Nazis viewed FDR. Very few people today, either on the left or on the right, seem to know precisely what fascism means. We can see this from the examples I cited earlier of how the progressive left routinely portrays Trump as a fascist and Republicans who support him as a kind of neo-Nazi party. Trump is said to be a fascist because he is an authoritarian, an ultra-nationalist, and a racist who derides Mexicans and Muslims and seeks to keep them out of this country. Doesn't Trump say he wants to make America great again in precisely the same tone that Hitler promised to make Germany great again? Actually, no. As I showed in The Big Lie, fascists aren't merely authoritarians. We've seen dictators around the world for more than a century, from Idi Amin to Ferdinand Marcos to Pol Pot. Obviously, these rulers were not all fascists. Moreover, Trump is not an authoritarian. If he were, would he permit himself to be flayed across all platforms in every form of media, from the Daily News to the commentators to the late-night comedians? Mussolini and Hitler would have dispatched their goons and shut those people down overnight. Trump's alleged racism arises out of his views on immigration. I mentioned earlier how Trump's distinguishing line is not a racial one. Rather, it is between legal and illegal immigrants. Admittedly, Trump has said he wants to change immigration laws to restrict immigrants who come merely through chain migration via the so-called family unification provision. Trump wants to admit more productive immigrants. But he includes in this definition capable Indian engineers and software guys. In any other country, Trump's proposal would be unremarkable. Most countries that take immigrants do so on the basis of national self-interest. If Canada and Australia need more doctors and nurses, they open their door to more doctors and nurses. They understand that, even under the liberal theory of the social contract, there is no right to immigrate. Immigration is a pact between those who want to move to another country and the people of that country who want to have them. Whatever you think of Trump's view on immigration, it is not racist. Trump's nationalism is nothing more than traditional American patriotism, surrounded by the familiar symbols of the flag, the anthem, and soldiers' graves. It should be emphasized that nationalism is not a distinguishing feature of fascism or Nazism. To take a few examples, Gandhi was a nationalist, as was Mandela. Other anti-colonial leaders were, to a man, nationalists. Winston Churchill was a nationalist, as was de Gaulle. The American founders were nationalists, and so was Lincoln. It makes no sense to call all these people fascist. Moreover, Mussolini and Hitler were not nationalists in the traditional or Trumpian sense. Mussolini once reviled the Italian flag as a rag to be planted on a dunghill. Traditional patriotism, Mussolini wrote, was a scheme for the capitalist class, the bourgeoisie, to win the loyalty of the people and protect its class privileges. Mussolini resolved to remake Italy, much as Obama in 2008 resolved to remake America. Mussolini's allegiance was never to the nation in general, but only to a fascist conception of the nation. Hitler, too, emphasized that he was not a patriot, because patriotism, as he understood it, involved affirming the ideas, institutions, and rituals of an existing society. Like Mussolini, Hitler sought to overthrow that society and replace it with something entirely new. His loyalty was neither to traditional Wilhelmine Germany nor to Weimar Germany, both of which he viewed as decadent. Hitler's dedication was only to his own futuristic ideal of what he termed the Völkisch, or fascist state. Perhaps the strongest evidence for Trump's fascism and neo-Nazism is that self-styled fascists, or neo-Nazis today, have been seen shouting Trump slogans and wearing Trump hats. I examine this phenomenon in a later chapter. But here I want to focus not on the neo-Nazis, but on real Nazis. A neo-Nazi, after all, is a Nazi wannabe. Hitler admirers circa 2018 are not the same as the people who actually served Hitler and administered the fascist state with all its attendant horrors. Whom did those people, including the fascist leaders Hitler and Mussolini themselves, support on this side of the Atlantic? Mussolini, it turns out, was an admirer of Franklin Roosevelt. Historian Stanley Payne writes in A Short History of Fascism that initially Mussolini thought better of FDR than of Hitler. Mussolini condescended toward Hitler at their first meetings and only changed his view after Hitler's successful conquests. But he was positively disposed to FDR from the outset. And the Duce and Roosevelt established personal contact even before FDR was inaugurated. Shortly after FDR unveiled the early programs of the New Deal, Mussolini reviewed his book Looking Forward in an Italian magazine. Mussolini concluded that FDR's policies and outlook were reminiscent of the ways and means by which fascism awakened the Italian people. Adopting a ponderous tone, Mussolini wrote, "The question is often asked in America and in Europe just how much fascism the American president's program contains." Mussolini's answer, a lot. Fascism, Mussolini said, is the principle that the state no longer leaves the economy to its own devices. Terming the New Deal boldly interventionist, Mussolini identified as its main goal replacing America's free market economy with an economy controlled and regulated by the centralized state. FDR, Mussolini concluded, was moving his country in the direction of national socialism and, without question, the mood accompanying the sea change resembles that of fascism. Around the same time, the official Nazi newspaper Volkischer Beobachter provided its views of America's new president. "We too, as German National Socialists, are looking toward America." FDR, the Nazi publication said, was replacing the uninhibited frenzy of market speculation of the 1920s with the adoption of National Socialist strains of thought in his economic and social policies. Of his policies, the paper concluded, we fear only the possibility that they might fail. On another occasion, the Volkischer Beobachter examined FDR's leadership style, which it found comparable to Hitler's own dictatorial style or Führerprinzip. Returning to FDR's New Deal policies, the Nazi paper noted that, if not always in the same words, FDR too demands that the collective good be put before individual self-interest. Many passages in his book could have been written by a National Socialist. In any case, one can assume he feels considerable affinity with the National Socialist philosophy. I get these quotations from historian John Patrick Diggins' Mussolini and Fascism, published in 1972 and virtually unknown today, and also from German historian Wolfgang Scheibelbusch's equally obscure study, Three New Deals. Not a single prominent FDR biographer or progressive history of the period gives us the scoop on fascist and Nazi enthusiasm for FDR. Even Ira Katznelson's admirable recent study, Fear Itself, the most honest progressive treatment of the links between the New Deal and fascism, artfully leaves out the most incriminating quotations. So the whole subject of fascism and Nazism is surrounded today by a thick vapor of vagueness and obfuscation. Young progressives go around screaming about fascism and Nazism, even though they have no idea what fascists and Nazis actually believed. We cannot fault them. They cannot find this information in their standard textbooks or in the general media. This darkness, this mirror of concealment, is a product of design, necessary to advance the progressive lie that fascism and Nazism are phenomena of the right. Let us therefore turn on the light and look behind the mirror. Fascism at its core. What is fascism? In his April 29, 1938 message to Congress, FDR warned that unhappy events abroad had taught the Americans a simple truth. The liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to a point where it becomes stronger than the democratic state itself. That, in essence, is fascism, ownership of government by an individual, by a group, or by any other controlling private power. We see here how FDR himself is one of the earliest inventors of the progressive big lie about fascism. Fascism is not about the growth of private power. It is about the unchecked growth of government power. Fascism is not about the private sector taking over the government. It is about the government taking over the private sector. FDR redefines fascism to make it look like he is saving American democracy from a fascist takeover by big business. He inverts the meaning of fascism to portray his Republican opponents as fascists while presenting himself as, well, the anti-fascist. FDR's lies live on in the present. In May 2017, the New York Times published an op-ed by Henry Scott Wallace, grandson of FDR's second vice president, Henry Wallace, defining fascism as a merger of state and corporate power. Wallace portrayed his grandfather as a champion of the people against the rise of fascist tendencies in America, drawing a straight line from the fascist Republicans of the 1930s to Trump and the GOP today. Nowhere does Wallace point out that his grandfather was a socialist, and that Hitler was the head of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. In line with contemporary progressives, Wallace is desperate to get the socialism out of National Socialism. Leftists regularly tell me on social media, Hitler wasn't a socialist. The Nazis just said that to get elected. They didn't enact any socialist policies. Don't you know Hitler persecuted the socialists and fought against the Soviet Union in World War II? Yes, I know. I also know that fascism, in its essence, is the centralization of power in the national state. Everything in the state, nothing outside the state, and nothing against the state. That was the fascist slogan drafted by Giovanni Gentile, the leading philosopher of fascism, and echoed by Mussolini, who created the first fascist regime in the world. Gentile adds, the authority of the state is not subject to negotiation. It is entirely unconditioned. Morality and religion must be subordinated to the laws of the state. For fascism, the fascist theoretician Alfredo Rocco wrote, society is the end, individuals the means, and its whole life consists in using individuals as instruments for its social ends. As this quotation suggests, the fascists of the 1920s and 30s described the state as a living organism, with each individual being a cell within the organism. Obviously, the cell has no value or identity or rights outside the organism. Its value is solely what it contributes to the larger whole. The second distinguishing feature of fascism was its forward-looking or progressive element. Progressives routinely portray fascism as reactionary in order to make it seem right-wing. But even the progressive historian Roger Griffin rejects this as a mischaracterization. Fascism is anti-conservative, he writes. It had a revolutionary, forward-looking thrust. It thus represents an alternative modernism rather than a rejection of it. One of the groups that strongly supported and eventually merged with the fascists was the Italian futurists. In Germany, too, self-described progressives and futurists embraced the revolutionary promise of fascism. Historians like A. James Gregor point out that fascists and communists recruited from the same sorts of people, malcontents who hated their society and sought to create another one from the ground up. Fascists, like communists, sought to create a new man and a new society, freed from the shackles of traditional mores, religion, and morality. Now ask yourself, does this sound right-wing or left-wing? You don't have to guess. In 2012, at the Democratic National Convention, Obama unveiled the slogan, "The government is the one thing we all belong to." This fascist apotheosis to the centralized state is a sentiment that Gentile and Mussolini would surely have applauded. It couldn't be more different from the American founders' view, which is that we don't belong to the government belongs to us. Mussolini was a Marxist, together with Antonio Gramsci, the most famous Marxist in Italy. Mussolini was the strong man of the revolutionary left who, in the words of historian Zeev Sternhell, never said a single word against socialism as a system of thought. Together with a group of revolutionary socialists known as the syndicalists, he created the first fascist party in the early 1900s and the first fascist state in 1922. Around the same time, fascist movements were started in England, in France, in Germany, and elsewhere in Europe. All the founders and leaders of early fascism, there are no exceptions, were men of the left. The leading French fascists were Jean Alleman, the grand old man of French socialism, Marcel Dié, founder of the Parti Socialiste de France, and Jacques Doriot, a French communist. The Belgian fascists were rallied by the socialist theoretician Henri Damann. In England, Oswald Mosley broke with the Labour Party, which he considered insufficiently leftist, and founded the British Union of Fascists. In Italy, Mussolini's fascists were all revolutionary socialists, and one of his regime's closest advisors was Nicola Bombacci, a founder of the Italian Communist Party. Hitler, too, was a man of the left. The leading Nazis were all committed socialists, as we can see from the Nazi 25-point platform released in the 1920s. The Nazis called for nationalization of large corporations and trusts, government control of banking and credit, the seizure of land without compensation for public use, the splitting of large land holdings into small units, confiscation of war profits, prosecution of bankers and other lenders for usury, abolition of incomes unearned by work, profit sharing for workers in large corporations, a broader pension system paying higher benefits, and universal free health care and education. Doesn't sound exactly like Trump's agenda, does it? It's not. And yet much of it is creepily familiar. Sure, some of the language is dated. Try crossing out the word usury and replacing it with its modern equivalent, interest. Also, cross out the word Jew and substitute Wall Street greed. Now the Nazi platform of 1920 reads like a progressive platform jointly drafted by Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. If read aloud at a left-wing gathering on campus, I am sure it would provoke thunderous applause. Mussolini and Hitler were national socialists not just in theory but also in practice. They established state control over all the major industries in their countries. Germany also created massive new state entities such as the Hermann Göring Reichswerk, a state-run conglomerate charged with increasing industrial output in preparation for war. Hitler went much further than Mussolini, largely because he had more power. Mussolini's regime included non-fascist elements, and he had to compromise with them. Unhampered by such constraints, Hitler enforced what the Nazis termed Gleichschaltung, the subordination of all the institutions of the culture to the ideological priorities of Nazism. Mussolini's regime had its own version of this, as Gentile put it, "For fascism, the state and the individual are one." But it was enforced in the Italian, which is to say, lackadaisical way. The Nazis, with German punctiliousness, implemented Gleichschaltung by forcing the media, the universities, and the film industry into full conformity. They called it working toward the Führer. Even private citizens were supposed to work toward the Führer at all times. This was the true meaning of draping the swastika on your balcony or giving the Heil Hitler salute. It signaled your willingness to be a servant or even a slave of the Nazi state. Thus, Gleichschaltung in its own way corresponded to the democratic master's dream on every slave plantation to have his slaves in full conformity with his dictates, one may say at all times working toward the master. Does all of this sound alarmingly familiar? It should. Today on the American left, Gleichschaltung has a different name, political correctness. Political correctness reflects the left's desire to impose voluntary ideological compulsion throughout the culture. No one is exempt, not even the poor Christian baker who simply wants to live by his conscience. He too must be browbeaten into submission and forced to serve the gay wedding couple whose lifestyle he finds objectionable and immoral. He too must, in his own way, give the Heil Hitler salute to contemporary leftist orthodoxy. While Hitler's National Socialism paralleled Mussolini's fascism in many respects, it differed in one big one. Hitler despised the Jews, and Mussolini did not. In fact, some prominent founders of Italian fascism, such as Angiolo Olivetti, were Jewish. Hitler was much more of a rabid racist than Mussolini. Yet even this racism, the German historian Götz Ely shows in two important recent books, served the cause of the left, and thus bears comparison with democratic racism on this side of the Atlantic. Ely's work stands out in the vast corpus of German scholarship on the Nazi regime because he asks questions that others don't. Ely's first question is, why did Hitler hate the Jews? It's not sufficient to answer that Hitler was a racist. Ely wants to know why he selected the Jews as his political targets. Ely's answer, Nazi anti-Semitism was rooted in envy. Hitler hated the Jews not because they were failures, but because they were successful. Hitler's own rhetoric concedes this. He fulminates against Jews for being unscrupulous, selfish, capitalists, engaged in exploitation of the ordinary German citizen. Distinguishing between productive capitalism and finance capitalism, Hitler accuses Jews of engaging largely in finance capitalism. In other words, of being greedy swindlers who make obscene profits by producing nothing. FDR, as we will see, also embraced this politics of envy and bequeathed it down to progressive Democrats of our own day. Ely then poses a second question. Why did the German people remain loyal to Hitler, even through a protracted war that reduced their nation to rubble? They had barely voted Hitler into office in 1933. Did they believe in him so much that they would stick with him to the bitter end? To answer these questions, Ely writes, it is necessary to focus on the socialist aspect of National Socialism. Ely concludes that German allegiance to Hitler was not out of pure conviction. They weren't just suckers for Goebbels's propaganda. Rather, Ely shows in a recent book, Hitler's Beneficiaries, that Hitler robbed from the Jews and other nations in order to fund Nazi socialist and redistributionist schemes. Once the Nazis had ousted the Jews from high positions in Germany, those positions went to other Germans. The Nazis confiscated Jewish property and art treasures. At the same time, Hitler pillaged other European countries of their wealth, and these resources were used by the state treasury to fund an expansion of the Volksstaat, or welfare state. Ely reports that by using all this stolen money, the Nazi leadership gave Germans their first taste of what it might be like to own an automobile. It introduced the previously almost unknown idea of vacations. Moreover, it insured farmers against the vagaries of the weather and the world market. Nazis pioneered the beginnings of environmental conservation. The National Socialists expanded the state pension system and passed rent control laws, tenants' rights laws, and laws restricting the rights of creditors. Thanks to Nazi largesse with the booty of war, many German workers also had their first taste of French silks, Belgian lace, and Dutch cheese. No wonder Ely concludes that the Germans stuck with their man. They were Hitler's satisfied thieves. Other socialists merely made extravagant promises, but the Nazi welfare state delivered the goods. Hierarchical though Nazism may have been in its organizational structure, it was also in this respect egalitarian. One may say that any government that robs Peter to pay Paul can usually rely on Paul's support. Once again, there would be a valuable lesson for FDR in this Nazi principle of building popular loyalty by using the government for the purpose of confiscation and wealth redistribution. That admirable Italian gentleman. Now let's see how FDR viewed fascism and how he created the uniquely American brand of it, in the process permanently transforming the progressive plantation. In 1933, FDR responded to a journalist who asked him his view of Mussolini. "I don't mind telling you that I'm keeping in fairly close touch with that admirable Italian gentleman." That same year, FDR again gave his view of Mussolini to Breckinridge Long, U.S. ambassador to Rome. "There seems to be no question that he is really interested in what we are doing, and I am much interested and deeply impressed by what he has accomplished and by his evidenced honest purpose of restoring Italy." FDR's enthusiasm for Mussolini and Italian fascism was echoed by other progressives of his time. The left-wing historian Charles Beard wrote of Mussolini's regime, "An amazing experiment is being made here. It would be a mistake to allow feelings aroused by contemplating the harsh deeds and extravagant assertions that have accompanied the fascist process to obscure the potentialities and lessons of the adventure." Herbert Croly, editor of the New Republic, insisted that fascism offered the potential for the spiritual reconstruction of society. Progressives in popular culture picked up the fascist tune. "You're the top, you're Mussolini," crooned Cole Porter in an early 30s hit song whose Mussolini reference was tactfully removed a few years later when the Italian fascists invaded Ethiopia. Mussolini dispatched members of his so-called brain trust to Rome to study fascist policies. He sent a second administrative team to examine the fascist organizational structure for the government. FDR advisor Rexford Tugwell, upon returning from Rome, wrote of fascism, "It is the cleanest, neatest, most efficiently operating piece of social machinery I've ever seen. It makes me envious." FDR regarded his National Recovery Act, NRA, as the most important of his New Deal programs. It was directly modeled on Italian fascism. The NRA empowered the federal government to establish coalitions of labor and management in every industry to set production targets, wages, prices, and even maximum and minimum working hours. These agreements would be reviewed by a government-run industrial advisory board answerable to FDR himself. According to Tugwell, the NRA was designed to eliminate the anarchy of the competitive system. FDR's man to run the NRA, General Hugh Johnson, was an avowed admirer of fascism who loved to associate himself with what he termed the shining name of Mussolini. Johnson carried with him and routinely quoted from a fascist propaganda pamphlet, The Structure of the Corporate State, written by one of Mussolini's aides. Under Johnson, the NRA issued its own brochure, Capitalism and Labor Under Fascism. It acknowledged that the fascist principles are very similar to those which have been evolving in America. We have seen how FDR was ideologically shaped by fascism. Now, let us explore how, like the Nazis, he made political use of racism. FDR wasn't a racist, at least not of the extreme form that Hitler was, but he was not above making a Faustian pact with his party's worst bigots in order to get his agenda passed. The conventional progressive wisdom is that FDR won political support for the New Deal by assembling an amazing coalition of big city bosses, poor white Southerners, farmers, laborers, Catholics, Jews, other ethnics, and blacks. But as progressive historian Ira Katznelson points out, these groups were not equally important for FDR. Consider blacks. Most blacks in the South did not vote, courtesy of voter suppression by the Democratic Party. True, a great migration had begun, in which blacks were moving from the rural South to northern cities, but FDR already had the cities, so he didn't care about the black vote there. What FDR needed was the votes of the racist Democrats from the South who sat on powerful committees that had the power to accelerate or block his New Deal programs. These racists were also progressives, who were generally behind FDR's programs, especially New Deal initiatives like the Tennessee Valley Project that benefited their region. Yet, recognizing how indispensable they were to FDR, the Democratic racists made three demands. First, they demanded that most New Deal programs like Social Security be designed in a way to exclude blacks. FDR agreed. Consequently, most New Deal programs excluded farm labor and domestic workers, recognizing that these were the two areas in which most blacks were employed. In Katznelson's words, blacks were excluded from the legislation that created modern unions, from laws that set minimum wages and regulated the hours of work, and from Social Security. These exclusions continued through the Truman administration and were only ended by Republicans in the 1950s. Second, the Democratic racists demanded that FDR protect segregation. FDR was on board. He refused to desegregate the armed forces, even though he had the power to do so. As Katznelson put it, in World War II, the United States in effect had two armies, one white, one black. Not entirely separate, they were utterly unequal. Desegregation would have to wait until the Truman era. FDR and progressive Democrats also prevented congressional Republicans from attaching anti-discrimination provisions to social programs. Again, it took Republicans in the Eisenhower era to finally remove these racist restrictions. Third, and most damning, the Democratic racists insisted that FDR block anti-lynching legislation. FDR was up for it. Despite a surge in lynching that provoked congressional Republicans and even some Democrats to get behind anti-lynching legislation, that legislation had no chance to pass without FDR's support. He withheld it, and the laws failed. Later, Truman followed in FDR's footsteps by refusing to make lynching a federal offense. We might expect this from a former Klansman like Truman, but why FDR? FDR seems to have agreed with his fellow Democrat James Burns of South Carolina, who warned that laws against lynching would arouse ill feeling between the sections and destroy the Democratic Party. FDR, in other words, was less concerned about black lives than he was about getting programs through and maintaining the Democratic Party's balance of support between the northern cities and the solid South. We should not unilaterally fault FDR here. The Northern Democrats were, as we have seen throughout this book, complicit in the underlying racism. When an anti-lynching bill came to the Senate floor in 1937, it was a progressive Northern Democrat, William Borah of Idaho, who denounced it as ill-timed, ill-advised, and unconstitutional. Seeing their cause was hopeless, proponents of the bill retreated, and FDR made no objection. Katznelson gives us a second example of what happened when Southern Democrats launched a procedural amendment to kill an anti-lynching bill. Northern Democrats, who might be expected to align with Republicans, did not. What is striking about this Katznelson writes is not the overwhelming support of Southern Democrats or the comparable degree of opposition by Republicans. It is rather the critical support for adjournment provided by non-Southern Democrats, almost half of whom voted to support the South's procedural move. Equally striking for me is that a progressive like Katznelson has blown the cover of FDR and the Northern Democrats. Katznelson doesn't just expose how the Democratic Party, North and South, accommodated racism. He even links Democratic racism to Nazi racism. And notice how he admits in passing that Republicans could be expected to oppose Democratic racism. Republicans, in other words, were the party of civil rights, not just in the 1860s, but right through the 1930s and 1940s. Katznelson's work is remarkable because he is virtually the only honest historian who has lifted the lid on FDR, revealing aspects of the man that have been concealed by two generations of biographers. Yet in the end, even Katznelson